First of all, before I start, I want to acknowledge and thank Rabbi Jay Kelman and Torah in Motion for sponsoring all of these lectures. If you haven't given him a yashar koach, I know what it's like to run programs. I do so in Renana. It's not easy to put things together, and deserves a great deal of hakara satov and thanks from everybody for helping to make Tisha B'Av more meaningful, go faster, palatable, and give you a lot of food for thought if you're lacking the other kind. In any case, I also want to just acknowledge and thank my wife, Susie, for those who were here for her presentation. It's not easy to open oneself up, and I love you dearly. Okay, what we're going to do today, we're going to have an interactive shiur. We're going to learn a very, very famous and important piece of Gemara. The Gemara that Chazal chose as the one story that epitomizes what occurred in Yerushalayim, what caused, in a very real sense, the Churban Beit HaMikdash, and the personification of what we call Sinat Chinam. The Gemara never wastes words. It shows this story very carefully. Many of you may be familiar with it, but I dare say that you've not learned it the way we're going to learn it today, in its entirety and in its intricate details, in order to arrive at some very powerful conclusions. So what we're going to do is we're going to learn this short little story together, and then we're going to become detectives and play whodunit and try to discern who is the villain in the story. And through that, I think we'll gather a lot of very important truths about then and about now. The story, first of all, many of you just have one copy. And you might have a two-pager, or you might have a single page. In any case, the story begins, you'll find at the top of the page, on the right-hand side, it has the number 110. So that's the side that we're on. If not, go to that side. And then, five lines from the bottom, you'll see a little line near the end of the line, before the word Akamtsa. You'll see an arrow on the right-hand side in the margin to tell you where we are for those who want to follow it, and it's important to follow it. I'm actually going to begin, although I put the line there, I'm going to begin two lines prior where you see two dots. Every word here is quite important in this short little story. And it begins, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Do you all see that, where the two diamonds are? Okay. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, said Rabbi Yochanan, my dichtiv, what does it mean when it is written, and this is a quote from Mishlei, the book of Proverbs, Ashrei Adam Mefachei Tamid, happy is the person who is always afraid. Afraid might be a strong word here, apprehensive might be an even better word. Umikshe libo, and the one who is hard-hearted, yipol bara'a, will fall in his evil. What does that mean? Asks Rabbi Yochanan. And his answer, akamtsa ubarkamtsa charuv Yerushalayim. If you learn the story that we're going to now learn, you will know what that phrase means. We'll come back to it later. Akamtsa ubarkamtsa charuv Yerushalayim. Because of Kamsa and Barkamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. A very dramatic, powerful statement. And now if you skip to where that line is, because the next line is about another story in the Gemara, but we're going to do this story. Akamtsa, and he repeats, Akamtsa ubarkamtsa charuv Yerushalayim. Because of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. And here's the story. Dahahu Gavra, there once was a man, Derachme Kamtsa, who was, Rachme in the Lashon of the Gemara is, you know, Rachme can mean who? It can mean HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But Rachme, in this case, because it comes from the word compassion, right? Rachamim. In the Lashon of the Gemara, it means he was friends with Kamsa. There once was a man who was friends with someone named Kamsa. Uba'al devavei bar Kamsa. But was the enemy, it really means he had a machloket with, he had an argument or an ongoing quarrel with someone named Bar Kamsa. Avad Seudata. He made a banquet. Must have been, as we'll see, a very, very elaborate banquet. Amar le l'shamei, and he said to his servant, his someone who maybe a schlepper, someone who goes and does odd jobs for him and works for him. So apparently he was a wealthy man. Zil aitele kamsa, go and bring me kamsa. In a sense, go and invite Kamsa to this party. Now, you know, in the old days, you could send a letter to invite someone, but a much more chashuv way of having someone come to your party was a personal escort. And even today, you find some people who will personally invite someone rather than send it through the mail. So he said to his servant, go and bring Kamsa. However, the servant was a bit of a schlemazel, and instead of getting Kamsa, azel aitele bar Kamsa, he went and he brought someone with a similar name, maybe something like Goldberg and Goldberger, Weinberg and Weinberger. He went, and instead of bringing Kamsa, he brought bar Kamsa. Okay. What happens next? Asa Ashkeche Dehavi Yasiv. Comes the host, we'll call him the host of the party, and he sees that Bar Kamsa, to his shock and surprise, is sitting at the party. Amarle, and he says, Michte, let's see. Hahu Gavra Baldavava Dahahu Gavra. This man is the enemy of that man. A rather perplexing phrase, which we'll come back to. And then he goes to Bar Kamsa and he says to him, my Baitacha, what the heck are you doing here? You're not invited to this party. What are you doing here? Kum, get up, puk, and get out. You are not wanted. Amarle, so presumably, notice by the way, that there are a lot of pronouns here in this story, and not for no reason. We'll talk about that. It's another clue when I will ask you in a few minutes who is the villain. But we can presume this is Bar Kamsa now, who says to the host, Ho'il va'ata'e Shavkan, as long as I'm here already, let me stay. I'll be happy to give you the cost of everything I eat and drink. Don't throw me out. I'll pay for my dinner. We're on the next page. Amarle, the host says to him, lo, nothing doing. I want you out. Amarle says Bar Kamsa, okay, I'll make you a better offer. Yahavni lach deme palga desudatich. Desudatich. I will pay for half, palga's half. I will pay for half of the cost of this whole banquet. Wow. Very magnanimous offer. Just don't throw me out. Amarle says the host, lo. No, I don't accept your offer. Amarle So Bar Kamtza has a final offer which no one could refuse. And he says, Yahavni lach demekula sudatech. I am willing to pay for the entire banquet. Everybody here. And it must have been a grand banquet, as we'll see in a moment. I'll pay for all of it. Just don't throw me out. Amarle, says the host, lo. Nothing doing. Nakte biyade. He lifted him up, and we can get this picture, like in the Old West, of someone being thrown out of a saloon. He lifts him up by the back of his jacket, the ukme, the afke, and he ignominiously throws him out of that party. Amar said, Bar Kamtza, perhaps when he picked himself up and dusted himself off, Ho'il v'have yatfe rabbanan, since the rabbis, and here we're talking about there must have been some very distinguished personages, perhaps even members of the Sanhedrin. Since the Rabbanan were sitting there, he said, v'lo mahube, and they didn't do anything to stop the host from throwing me out, shmamina kanichlehu. That tells me that they approve of everything that was done. As we say, shtika kahoda'a. Silence is admission and approval. They did nothing, therefore they're responsible, they're guilty. They must have gone along with it. So what does he do? Bar Kamtza is not one to be trifled with, and he's a clever fellow. Azil ichel behu kurtza bimalcha. He goes and he creates an insurrection, a rebellion, as it were, of the Jewish community against the Romans. He orchestrates an act of rebellion. What does he do? Azil amrle le kesar. He goes and says to the Caesar, Mardu bach Yehudai, the Jews are planning to rebel against you. They are fomenting a rebellion against you, O Caesar. Amarle says, presumably Caesar, back to me, Amar, who told you that? How do you know that that's true? Amarle, shadr lehu kurbana. I'll tell you what, let's make a test. Let's have you, the emperor, send an offering to the Jews, to the temple. Chazit, and let's see, ima karvin le, if they accept your offering. That'll be a sign. If they reject your offering, then obviously they have no use for you, they hate you, and they're planning to rebel against you. If they accept it, okay, then maybe I'm wrong. But of course, he's very clever. What does he do? Azil shader bidei igla tlasa. He goes and he chooses, what Rashi says, igla tlasa, is a choice egel, a choice lamb, calf. Bahadei dekaasi shader be muma. But what does he do? He takes his knife and he makes a little defect in that calf. Beniv svatayim, a cut on its lip. Va'amrile, or some say, not a cut on its lip, but bedukin shaba'ayin, on its eyelid. Why? Duchta deledidan hava muma, uledidehu lav mumahu. He does something which, as far as anyone else could see, that calf is unblemished. It's perfect. It's beautiful. But in terms of halacha and those who administer the Beit HaMikdash, although it's a tiny little nick, it's still considered a mum, a blemish, thus making the animal impermissible to be brought for an offering. So now the trap has been set. What's going to happen? Are they going to accept that slightly blemished calf or not? So the rabbis know that this is a serious issue. So they call a meeting together. They have a high-level powwow between all the rabbis. And they know what the consequences are. They understand what's going on here. That the result of their discussion could lead to the destruction of the city by the Caesar, by the emperor. So they come up with a plan. Savara banan likrove. The plan A is, you know what? Let's let it pass as an offering. Let's bring that as an offering, and the emperor will be okay. He'll be pacified. Everything will be fine. There'll be no repercussions. Life will go on. And that's their plan. However, mishum shalom malchus, because they want peace with the government. They don't want a war. Amar lahu, Rabbi Zechariah ben Afkulis, suddenly, an obscure fellow named Rabbi Zechariah ben Afkulis, he stands up and he says, what? You're going to bring that as an offering? That's your plan? Yomru bale mumin kriven legabe mizbeach? And let everyone say it's permissible to bring a blemished animal on the altar, on the mizbeach? That's what you're going to do? Nothing doing. Okay, plan B. Savar lemiktale, de lo lezo velema. Plan B is, let's kill Bar Kamsa. Get rid of him. And then the danger will be passed. We'll solve the problem. With Bar Kamsa out of the way, we'll be able to somehow get out of this mess. Once again, Amar Lahu Rab Zecharia stands up, this Rab Zecharia ben Afkulis, and he says, what? Kill him? Yomru matil mum b'kedashim yarog? And have people say that because you made a blemish in an animal, you deserve to be killed? Amar Rabbi Yochanan, says Rabbi Yochanan in response to all this, An vitanuto shel Rabbi Zechariah ben Afkulis, hachriva et beitenu v'sarfa et hechalenu v'glitanu me'artzenu. The quote-unquote humility of Rabbi Zechariah caused our house to be destroyed, the Beit HaMikdash, and our sanctuary to be burnt, and our people to be exiled from this land. And without coming to any conclusive decision, Bar Kamsa goes through with his plan. The emperor now is deeply suspect, and the offering is refused. The Gemara goes on to say that the emperor shoots arrows in every direction. Similar story we have about Nebuchadnezzar, and the arrows always point to Jerusalem, giving him a sign from above that indeed I will be successful and I can put down this rebellion. Bar Kamsa shows him a way through the walls. He enters, burns down the Beit HaMikdash, and destroys Jerusalem. And that's the story. And this is the story of how Yerushalayim was destroyed. A story that apparently Chazal feel epitomize everything that's wrong and the cause of all of our misfortune. And so we begin our detective hunt. Who is the villain in this story? Somebody give me a possibility. Who is the villain in this? Just one, for starters. Who is the villain? Who is the villain in this story? Okay, well, you must be a congregant because your first reaction is the rabbis are to blame. But it's certainly a valid, and you said that as the rabbi walked in, so I just want you to know he said the rabbis are at fault. So, okay, so number one, so the first answer we heard was that the rabbis are at fault. Let's hear another one, just one person. Another one. Hold on a second. What did you say? The host. the host. That certainly makes a lot of sense to me, because the host started the whole problem when he wouldn't let Bar Kamsa stay at the party. Well, that's a second possibility, the host. Who else could it be? Who? Yeah, the shaliach. He seems like the last person we'd want to blame. He's the schlepper. But had he delivered the invitation to the right person, to Kamsa rather than Bar Kamsa, then you're right. None of this would have happened. So that's a third possibility. Who else could it be? Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulis says Rav Yochanan directly to him, "You burnt down the Beit HaMikdash. You." Well, more on that later. So that's already four. Who else could it be? Hold on to that answer, because that may be one of our bottom lines. But who else, meanwhile? Okay, thank you. Bar Kamsa. I mean, after all, he is the one who went to, he fomented this whole plan, and he's the one who incited the emperor and put the Jews in a bad light, in a bad position, to where ultimately the emperor acted, and we know what happened. Who else could it be? Is there anybody else? Who else? Okay. That seems like, you know, a crazy answer, but it's exact. How did we start the whole story? Akamtsa ubar kamtsa charav Yerushalayim. Because of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa, Yerushalayim was destroyed. We've got a lot of candidates here. And we have to try to unravel this, because I don't know. You may be right that everybody is correct, but we got to figure it out. I would have said, number one answer, when I read this story, seems to be the host. Correct? There's only one problem. What is the problem with saying that the host is the real villain? Think about the story for a moment. What's the problem? What? Very good. Because he's the person in the story that is nameless. Hahu Gavra. There once was a man who will go nameless. Oh, I don't understand. If he's the villain, here you are for the rest of posterity pointing a finger at Kamsa, at Bar Kamsa, at Zechariah ben Avkulis. But they're all named. If the real villain is the host, why does he go nameless? Well, that's something we have to ponder. Now, I have another question for you. We said that, and the way we introduced the story, Akamtsa ubar Kamtsa, Charuv Yerushalayim. So, we identify those two individuals as at the head of our story as being the villains. But what's problematic with that? Who is innocent? Kamsa! Kamsa's sitting at home. I don't know what he's doing. He's drinking a pina colada. He's reading a papyrus, parchment, whatever. He never gets an invitation. And for the rest of history, his name is identified first, by the way, as the villain. If I was him, I would say, me? I didn't even get invited to the Verstinkene party. I wasn't there. And now I'm the one being blamed? Why what? What do you mean? He didn't know about it. He never got an invitation. Interesting idea, perhaps. He said, why didn't he speak up? Why didn't he, presumably he would have known about this party. But, on the surface, it almost seems like he's a victim, not a villain. What do you say? Yeah, well, that makes the host look even worse. And, you know, that's why he was certainly one of our candidates. Let's take a look at one sentence here that I mentioned as we went over it is very perplexing. When the host sees that Bar Kamsa is sitting at the party, the Gemara records, Michte, that he says, Michte, let's see, Hahu Gavra, that man, Baldavavada Hu Gavra, is the enemy of that man. Now that's a very strange sentence. What should it say? He looks and he sees Bar Kamsa, and what should he say? He should say, that's my enemy. Huh? That man sitting there, Bar Kamsa, is my enemy. But he doesn't say that. One interpretation could be, since he was called before Hahu Gavra, that man, meaning me, because that's how the host was referred to, is the enemy of that man. I mean, it's very convoluted. What does it mean? Why doesn't he say, hey, there's my enemy, Bar Kamsa, I want him out? What's the implication? He knows who he is, because obviously he wants him out of the party. He knows who it is. But the implication is what? Why doesn't he say, hey, that's my enemy, I want him out? Yes, it wasn't his enemy. Whose enemy was it? No, whose enemy was it? We know. It was Kamsa's enemy, because the Gemara told us that in the very beginning. Although it said, Hahu gavra derachmei Kamsa, ubaldevave bar Kamsa. But the way in which, in other words, there was a man who was friends with Kamsa but enemies with bar Kamsa, the implication by the fact, and this is a commentary, it's not my commentary, that he uses that convoluted language is that he's saying, he's not necessarily my enemy, but he's what? He's the enemy of my friend. And the enemy of my friend is automatically my enemy. Apparently what we're seeing and why this story is chosen is that things reach the point in Yerushalayim and in that commonwealth where there was such enmity between people that no one could be neutral, that you had to take a side. If you are friends with my enemy, you're my enemy too. And therefore, as a result of that, there was apparently such a fierce battle between Kamsa and Bar Kamsa that everyone was taken into it. And that's why the Gemara says, Akamsa ubar Kamsa Haruv Yerushalayim. Even though Kamsa wasn't there, didn't matter. He was a party to that horrible, divisive machloket that sucked everybody else in. And therefore, rightly so, the Gemara castigates him, even though he didn't attend the party. Yes. Okay. One of the other ideas that's a possibility is that there was such enmity that it could even have reached the stage of father and son. Because literally, Bar Kamsa means the son of Kamsa. That's how terrible the stage it had gotten to, where there was such infighting. Now, let's ask you another question. What's intriguing about the name? What's intriguing about the name here? What's the name? Okay. What does that mean? No. In Gemara Lashon, what is Kamsa? Okay. There is a type of offering. Very good. There is a type of offering. Do you know in the Beit HaMikdash, they had animal offerings, but they also had meal offerings, mincha, flour offerings. And how much would they take? Melo kumtso. Melo kumtso was how much flour you could gather in your hand, in your fist, that was the amount necessary to make the karban. So the word kumtsa comes from that word, and as we said, in English we have a perfect translation for it. Someone who is a kamtsan in modern Hebrew is a cheapskate, and literally tight-fisted. The word derives from that idea of putting that and holding it in your fist, the metaphor being, I take a coin and I hold it in my fist so tight, nobody can, the strongest beggar can't pry it out of my hand. I'm tight-fisted, I don't let go of that coin. That's the name that's used here. By the way, it's not clear that that's the real name. But if that's so, what doesn't make sense? He offers to pay for the whole party. Wow, I would like to meet cheapskates like that. That come along and say, we'll pay for your whole bar mitzvah, just invite me. I'll pay for the whole, we had a double bris here today. Somebody comes along and says, invite me, I'll sit in the back, I won't bother anybody, I'll pay for the whole thing. I would not call such a person a kamtsan, and yet we call the person kamtsan bar kamsa. I like that. That's a good thought. True. But you can interpret it another way. Right? I like that. He offers to pay. He's clearly, maybe you're right, maybe he's out of character doing something because he's so determined not to be embarrassed. And of course, that's part of the issue. You know, embarrassment, and we'll come to that in a moment. But you also could say, beyond that, what? How does the name actually does fit? How does the name fit? It may not fit in terms of money, but think. But what? What is a kamtsan? What did we just say it is? Someone who what? Someone who? Or go further, someone who is doing what? What's he doing? When you're tight-fisted, what are you doing? You're what? Holding on to something for dear life. That's the implication. They are holding on to this machloket ad kedei kach that even money won't dissuade them. Usually, money has a way of solving a lot of problems. As we know, Chazal, you make compromises, this one comes along, you pay a little money here, somehow you assuage someone's feelings. Not here. It had reached the point where they were holding on to this machloket for dear life, and they're not letting it go. Yes. Perhaps. I mean, that's a supposition that maybe he was trying to save, you know, his friend. But nevertheless, when it reached that point and Bar Kamsa appealed to him and said, I'm willing to pay all this money. Okay, but he sees, if he's really a person with sensitivity, he'll also be sensitive to throwing this guy out publicly and causing him terrible embarrassment, which he does. But clearly, the implication seems to be that they are both holding on to this, not letting it go, and involving everyone else. Notice for a moment, where does Bar Kamsa make the blemish in the animal? Gemara gave two possibilities. What were they? One was the lips and the other in the eye. What's the implication here? The way you talk about someone and the way you look at someone. It wasn't by coincidence. That was his way of saying, everything that's wrong with Yerushalayim. The way that people talk about others, and we heard just previously the lecture which began with some of these, and Susie mentioned it as well, the terrible way that we misuse our power of speech, and that we talk about others in the most vile language, and the way we look at others. You know, in the old days, there was often a tradition, you read about this a lot in Hasidic stories, where the Rebbe dresses up like a peasant. You've all known these stories about, you know, especially in Hasidic stories. The Baal Shem Tov, right, will dress up in peasant garb, go incognito, and mingle among the people so he gets a real idea of what's going on the street, so he gets to know his people. Often, I will say to Rashi Yeshiva, what you need to do once a year is take off your hat, take off your black suit, what Mark Angel called last week the Ashkenazic funeral garb. Take it off once in a while, put on a sweatshirt, put on a baseball hat, and mingle among the people and see the real world and see what's out there. And also see how you're treated. Because in a very real sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has X-ray vision. He doesn't see what you're wearing. He really doesn't care what you're wearing. What you wear today that you think is religious garb, 500 years ago in some other place, you would be mocked. And they would say, who is that radical extremist wearing what they're wearing? HaKadosh Baruch Hu really doesn't care what you're wearing. You have to dress a certain mechubad way, you know, and cover yourself properly. But the fact is, the way in which we have come to judge other people, by what kippah you wear, by if you wear a hat, or what kind of hat, or the color of your suit, this is all complete and utter nonsense. I often say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu keeps us around, despite all of our actions, because he has a wonderful sense of humor, and we must make him laugh, because of all the crazy things we Jews do. And one of them is putting so much emphasis where it doesn't belong on the superficial external aspects of a person and very little on the neshama, which is the real person. Your clothes are just a way to keep your neshama warm and let it get through the day with some degree of respect. But it's not who we are. And apparently that was part of the message of Bar Kamtza, that he wanted them to see how, and the Gemara wanted us to see, what really is the blemish. What are the blemishes that ultimately make us an unfit carbon, so to speak? Yes, sir. We're to assume that this is the kind of sinat chinam the Gemara is saying. The Gemara in Yuma points to this story as well and says this is an example, this story of the sinat chinam that destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. And it apparently reflected a mentality and a society that was completely out of moral control. Let's talk for a moment about Rav Zachari ben Akfkulis. Because Rabbi Yochanan fingers him as the villain. What does he do? Let's think about this for a moment. Remember that they have two plans. Plan A, let's bring the blemished animal as a karban. Fine. Okay, shalom, you know, shalom alchus. Darkei shalom, let's just bring it. And he gets up and says, what? You can't do that. And then they say, plan B, let's kill Bar Kamsa. And he says, what? You can't do that. Is he a makel or a machmer? Think about that for a second. Is he strict or moderate? What we call today, is he a machmer who always takes the hardest position? Or is he a makel who takes a more lenient position? Which is he? He takes a hard position. Why? When they say, let's kill Bar Kamsa, he says, you can't kill him for such a small infraction of bringing a blemished animal? That doesn't deserve the death penalty. I'm not going to let you be strict. On the other hand, when they want to bring the carbon that's blemished, he says, what? And let people say you're allowed to bring a blemished animal on the Mizbeach? Then what is he being? Then he's being strict. Then he's saying what? Just because you want to bring about peace with the Roman government and you want to save 2 million Jews from being killed, you're going to allow a blemished animal to be brought as a carbon with a tiny blemish? I'd rather let 2 million people be killed. What's the common denominator here? If you go back and look, what's the phrase that he repeats? That's the key. Because you can't say he's a machmir or a makel. Because he goes both ways. But what does he repeat? Yomru. What does it mean? What? And people will say. Do you understand what he's doing? What matters to him is not so much the ramifications, but what will people say? In this case, not my Yomru HaGoyim, but my Yomru HaAm. It's very fascinating that who is it that castigates him? Rav Yochanan. Now, this may not be Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, but it certainly caused, it's a bit of a debate as to who this Rav Yochanan is. But if we use our rabbinic license a little bit, and at least it's connected to the same name of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, think for a moment exactly of the story of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. What happened? What did Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai do? Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, what did he want to do? He wanted to make an accommodation with the Romans. And of course, they said, nothing doing. This is a fight to the death. Anyone who dares try to make peace, right? These were the zealots, the Askariot, called so because of these little knives. If you would do something against their extreme position, they would come behind you, stab you with their knife. And so what did he do, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai? How? He faked his death, was put into a casket, and then was taken in a procession outside the walls. The only time someone could be let out was for a burial, and then got out of the casket and went straight to the Romans. And we all know what happened. The whole story where he says to the governor, he calls him emperor, how dare you call me emperor? Then he becomes emperor and he says, I'll give you 3 wishes. And he has et cetera, et cetera. And one of them is to establish Yavne. And needless to say, there were those who considered him a traitor. The Rav has a whole discussion about, even till the end of his life, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai wondered, did I do the right thing because I didn't ask for Yerushalayim to be saved? And he's, in the end, he's vindicated that he did the right thing. But the point is, he took an action that clearly the sentiment of the establishment was against. It was something that if he would have thought, my Yomru, what will people say? They would have said, you traitor! We're in a life and death struggle against the Romans and you go over to their side and you cut a deal with the Romans without our permission that we would never agree to. So it's fascinating that it's Rav Yochanan who says to Zechariah ben Apkulis, Anvitanuto. He talks about him in the third person, which is a very demeaning way, although they're sitting together probably, points to him and says, the quote-unquote, the false humility of this guy caused the destruction of the city and the ultimate exile and all the horrors that flowed from it. In other words, that sometimes, you know, it's a false humility. What? Would I dare to do something that other people would look at me and, you know, criticize me? Yes. Yes, that's what Judaism needs. And that's what it needed. It needs somebody to stand up and to say, and Rav Zecharia, he froze everybody else into non-action. And you see that happen all the time. Right? I mean, what will we say? If we put a picture of a woman dressed in a shaitan and a sneeze fashion in our magazine, what will they say? They'll say we're up because we show that women exist. What is that? Until somebody who has a little bit of courage stands up and says, you know what? HaKadosh Baruch Hu created men and women. I don't want to get too political. But give me a break. Give me a break. Rav Moshe Feinstein was often very proud to publish pictures of himself and his wife. And he had no sense of shame that this is my wife. But we're more frum than Rav Moshe, I guess. And so we don't want to show those pictures, and we want to eliminate them 100%. Until someone comes along, Bezrat Hashem, who has a sense of moral courage and says, we got to do what we got to do, and I don't care, my Yomru. Like Rav Yehuda Anasi, who wrote down the Mishnah, and everybody screamed and yelled and castigated him. How dare you? You're not allowed to do that. Until he stood up and says, I can do it. You don't like it? It's your problem. History will show who was right and who was wrong. Well, the Rambam, when they burnt his books, and in Rav Moshe, when he freed Agunot, and all kinds of examples of people who stood up and had courage, while the others were frozen into inaction, by looking over their shoulder, what will that one say about me? What will the street say? And therefore, Rav Yochanan was a good person, at least by name, to criticize Rav Zecharia ben Akulis. Yes. Right, so better 2 million people should die. But I'm saying that's his thinking. Whatever the rationale is, if you see the bigger picture, you say to yourself, so I'm going to let 2 million people die? And it indicates, too, what's going on in the community. Rav Yochanan is disagreeing with him, but apparently he's not successful in swaying the body, the majority, that's making the decision. They're all scared. Yes. Yes. Okay. So the Sinas Chinam seems to derive from the fact that even people who didn't have any personal stake in this machloket, they're drawn in, and the whole city, in a sense, is pitted one against the other, even though they're not a direct participant in the fight. Whatever the fight was between Kamsa Bar Kamsa, including the fact that maybe it was a family fight, whatever it was, it involved those two, but it didn't involve everybody else. But as the Gemara indicates, by the lack of the name for the host, it doesn't matter who he is. You know who the host is? Who's the host? What? Somebody said it. Every man. The host is every man. And every man is being sucked in to where they're saying, even if I don't necessarily know you, Hahu Gavra Baldavavid, Hahu Gavra, this one doesn't even need a name. This one's fighting this one, the Hatfields, the McCoys, nobody really knows why. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks down and he sees all of these things that are in the story. He sees the hatred, the almost obsessive hatred of one element against the other, even to the point where money won't sway them. And I mean, I don't want to sound too anti-Semitic, but a guy comes along, he's going to pay for the whole banquet. Usually that's enough to let him sit in the back. And he sees that, and he sees the inaction of the rabbis, which later on, the Gemara, just to reveal a secret, later on the Gemara, a few daf later, they come back and they agree that really the rabbis, the buck stops there, that really the rabbis are the ones who have to ultimately take a stand and take a moral stand, and they're responsible when it all deteriorates because they should know better and they're the leaders. But I suggest that what we heard before from that gentleman at the back, he's right too, that everyone has a chelek in this korban. It's not only, I don't say this just as a rabbi, it's not only the rabbis, it's really all of those who go along with the machloket, all of those who won't say, ad kan velo yoter, I'm not prolonging, continuing this battle. I'm going to end the battle. I'm going to make shalom. I'm going to take a stand and do what's necessary. I'm going to be sensitive, not throw this person out and embarrass them so in public. All of these contributed to the state that Jerusalem was in, to the point where HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you know what? We better tear it down and start over again someday, because what we've got now is just hopeless. And therefore, the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa is quite fittingly put in what Masechta? In Gittin. Because it is part of our divorce from God. When we lost that intimacy and that love and that respect that matrimony is based on, there's almost no choice but to resort to a get. And it's a sad, sad statement and a sad story. But the antidote, the tikkun, of course, is to remarry in a sense. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not marry anybody since. And unless you're a Kohen, although we're supposed to be a, Mamlechet Kohanim, unless you're a Kohen, you can remarry the same person. We can establish the intimacy with HaKadosh Baruch Hu again. That's the challenge, to eradicate all of those many factors that make this story such a negative and distasteful comment on the community, to speak right about people, to look at people without prejudice, to, rather than embarrass but respect people, to take a stand when necessary, to see the bigger picture, and to ultimately unify the Am so that we can have that relationship. And once again, once we have the relationship, God will give us the house to live in, and that's the Bayit Shlishi V'Acharon B'Mehrev Yameinu. Amen.